Welcome, everybody. I'm your host, Nick Spiro, and this is the first edition of a live edition of Circus Maximus, streaming live through YouTube right now. So please join us in the chat room over there. I do have a guest joining me tonight. He is with me now, Lark from Texas. Welcome to the live edition of Circus Maximus on a YouTube stream.
Well, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's been a while since we last spoke. Lots happened since then, Lark. We've had a lot of events such as the Vegas shooting. We've had natural disasters, allegedly natural disasters that have taken place here in America. We've had some dissidents that have gone missing, such as Brendan O'Connell. We've had Jonathan Azizaiah, a friend of mine who has left Canada to avoid any sort of judicial court that would require him to go in front of a judge to fight so-called hate speech that occurred in his lyrics of music that he wrote. So he's been pretty quiet and low-key because of this. And Brendan O'Connell, there's some word that he's been arrested in New Zealand. So there's that other person who is a voice out there. So Lark is another voice that of reason. I listened to him call into a show of some other host, and he was discussing topics that I felt were explosive, and I was able to paint a picture of what he was describing of what is actually going on today with, or why things are happening. And there was a term used, communitarianism. So Lark, what is communitarianism?
Well, the short answer is it is the scientific dictatorship of the community. And of course you have to define your terms. Important to policy initiatives, directives, and so forth is always the Hegelian dialectic and how that impacts upon us both internally and externally as a phenomenon in our daily life, in our public conversations, shall we say, across multiple media pathways. And it's also a tool of social engineering and brainwashing. And communitarianism, in fact, is the elephant in the room. It's the one word answer to the so-called climate change that all of us are experiencing today, because it ties directly to what is known as communitarian law. And I can expand upon that whenever you wish.
Well, yes. And there's also the concept of how Talmudic law is communitarian law. So if communitarian law is Talmudic law, what is Talmudic law?
Well, the first thing that the Talmudists will say is that no, it's not Talmudic law. It also includes canonical, ecclesiastical, Islamic, you know, because it impacts upon all the religions. So if you can imagine, they take the quote unquote best ideas from all the world's religions and they roll them all together. We can call that as impacting upon communitarian law, but it also coincides with so-called UCC or commercial law and also international law. But what I have noticed in my research is that there isn't anything that I've seen that is adopted within these other types of law that does not comport with Talmudic law. And of course, that's informed by things like the Zohar, or what we know euphemistically as perhaps Kabbalah. But in brief, it is most definitely not fixed law. You know, so for the constitutionalists out there that might style themselves as originalists, as opposed to the people who think of the document that we call the Constitution, the law of the land, as being a living document. This is what we're faced with today. It is most definitely a living document, but it has been it's been twisted inside out, and it's overlaid. It's been overlaid with international law. In fact, in contracts between multinational corporations transnationally, we used to see a clause that was simply called the supremacy of communitarian law. And the reason is because, for instance, in Europe, the EU law today is known as, in French, acquis communautaire, which in English simply translates as communitarian law. Now, this law was more than 50 years in the making. And this law, with these trade agreements, so-called, what I call British mercantilism, what it does is it destroys national boundaries. It erases the concept of the nation state in favor of something called the market state, but the globalized market state.
Lark, real quick, for the audience, just for people, a little tidbit. The first free trade agreement that America ever went into with a nation was with Israel. And all of the other trade agreements that followed modeled that trade agreement.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, I'm thinking back, for instance, the time of Bretton Woods and the first GATT treaty. Although that was the World War II era, but it can certainly go back even further, frankly, to General Orders Number 100.
Wouldn't a lot of this go back to even the Indies companies?
Oh, indeed. Yeah, because, I mean, this nation that we call America has never been free, sovereign, or independent. Never been. We've always been tied to the crown and or to the crowned heads of Europe, which includes the Vatican, and anybody else that was tied to those bloodlines. And so to this day, Americans, by and large, commoners-born Americans like you and me, for instance, we don't have a lodial title to our property. When you pay off a mortgage, you're still listed as a tenant. You're paying property taxes. So remember what the Marxists always wanted. The Marxists always really wanted the same thing as the capitalist, and particularly the uber-rich capitalist. You know, those trust fund babies that never worked a day in their life because they were inheritors of great wealth. They wanted the absence of competition. They wanted a monopoly. And that means a monopoly on everything. You know, you...
they even have a monopoly on violence, a monopoly on the police force, the judicial systems, just how they're able to manipulate and control the masses in general.
Well, that's true, and they intend to have it. I mean, they're after our ability to defend ourselves in our own homes. But the truth of the matter is the American people have become a nation of squatters, interlopers, and beggars.
When did this all start happening, Lark? When would you pinpoint the beginning of all this as far as when this feudal-type system was re-engaged, or did it ever end?
I don't think it ever ended, just like I don't think slavery ever ended. We can trace it back certainly to the European medieval guild system. But we can also take it back, pre-recorded history into antiquity, you know, in terms of how societies and social structures are organized.
So back to the Talmudic law system, as far as my understanding goes, a lot of these Judaic holy books, holy for them, maintain the idea that they're a superior race, per se, of people, and any non-Jew will be a servant. And they also claim that when their Messiah does come, that they'll have so many different a number of slaves that are Gentiles to serve them.
Well, and, you know, there's much to say about that. I know on my own radar screen, we had the so-called Education and Sharing Day, I think back in 1991, during the Bush Senior administration. And it's euphemistically known today as simply Education Day, but it's celebrated according to the Mazda calendar, which is the Jewish calendar. It's a lunar calendar. And so the date every year is commemorated on a different day of the week in the month. And the American people don't know much about this, but basically what that put into effect is the seven Noahide laws.
And the calendar, what are they, about 3,070 years ahead of our current year that we go off of the Gregorian?
I can't really say. I can't really speak to that. I just know that it's a different timeline. It's a different calendar altogether. Don't forget, I think we're still on the Gregorian calendar.
I think it's 3,770 years, because wasn't it just 777 for them?
Well, again, I can't answer that. I can't speak to that. I've read a lot about it, but I'm not conversant.
Not a problem. So with what I stated as far as the superiority that a group of people have, it also appears that this technocracy, a lot of the high-level startup companies that end up getting absorbed into multinational tech companies like Apple and IBM and whatnot, a lot of these startup companies are coming from Israel. Are you familiar with the Talpiot program and a lot of the startups that come out of a intelligence unit called Unit 8200 from Israel?
I am. I'm not particularly conversant, but I've noticed some time ago that there are, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, for instance, World War III began the moment World War II ended. And the same is true of World War I. I mean, this war goes back a long, long time. What I see today, though, is remember John D. Rockefeller said that competition is a sin. And what I see today when it comes to the telecommunications industry, the public utility industries, the communications industries.
Social media would be part of the communications in a sense. Yeah.
And as far as I'm concerned, the World Wide Web and the Internet is owned by these people because they are the people that won World War I and World War II and the so-called war between the states before them.
Yeah, you and I talked offline about psychometrics, companies like Cambridge Analytica. Peter Thiel has a company similar called Plant Air, I believe. So these psychometrics, behavioral analytics companies who gather intel, scouring the interwebs from social media profiles to surveys, things of that nature. What are your thoughts as far as why they're doing this and where it can go from here with that information that they have gathered?
Well, it's all about total control. Remember, Hegel himself has rightly been called the father of totalitarianism. And so, you know, if the listeners would just type into their search engine, what is the Hegelian dialectic? They're going to get some answers along those lines. If they type into their search engine, what is communitarianism? What is communitarian law? Rights, responsibilities, and communitarianism. They're going to get a feel for what we're talking about here. But is it, you know, what we're really talking about is mimetic warfare.
Oh, we sure saw a lot of that during the Trump campaign.
Oh yeah, and so when we talk about social media today, what we're engaged in really is a battle for mind space. It's also termed battle space. These are one word, new words in the lexicon. But you know, meme warfare or mimetic warfare is only one example of the types of warfare being waged upon us right now. You know, the other ones concerning these false flag attacks and these phony terrorist events that are completely staged, managed, and acted out for our consumption. Those are examples of nonlinear warfare and the work of Vladislav Surkov, who's an advisor to Vladimir Putin. Because remember, the same people that control Britain and Europe and Canada and Mexico and the U.S. and Japan and China and the former USSR and Russia are the same people.
Agreed.
They're the same people.
Agreed.
And so, yeah, look it up. Nonlinear warfare, a new system of political control. This is on YouTube. And then we also have psychological warfare. We have asymmetric warfare. We have biological warfare. Again, mimetic warfare. We have economic and spiritual warfare. These are all being waged upon us, against us right now. And a lot of times, unfortunately, we can become instruments of our own exploitation or demise. And the reason is because if we're propagating false narratives or falsehoods, period, then we get to the meat of the matter, because where we're headed and where we are is in a time of actual technological slavery. And whether one is a dupe or a shill, the result is the same. So you think you're doing good, but maybe you're doing harm. Because again, this goes to the heart of what is the Hegelian dialectic. The Hegelian dialectic cannot work, whether in the public mind or in the individual's mind, unless they take a side. They have to take a side. And this is a hard thing for people to grasp, but it's true. When you take a side and you're very vocal about it, for instance, the white nationalist or Black Lives Matter or what have you, then what you're doing is you are advancing Marx and Engels' grand design for a dictatorship of the proletariat. But see, communitarianism is considered a more evolved social evolution of what even Marx said was not going to be the final solution to the problems in terms of governance of mankind. And so now we have today the dictatorship of the community.
There's a article you shared with me called Communitarianism, the Dictatorship of Everything, written in 2007 by Nancy Levant. Can you summarize that article?
Well, communitarianism itself is described or defined as an all-encompassing ism or school of thought. Now, we have to think about that for just a moment. You know, I've listed what I consider to be a concise yet comprehensive list of the most important schools of thought or isms which comprise this all-encompassing school of thought called communitarianism. But that's what she does. In that article, Nancy cites a lot of the work, the research done by Nikki Rapana and her daughter, Nordica Friedrich. And, of course, they've written a book that was revised in 2012 called The Definitive Anti-Communitarian Manifesto. And anybody can purchase this book for under $20 on the Internet. And it's well worth their reading it. But bear in mind, when we look at these words, to read and to write, if we look them up etymologically as well as just in any dictionary or encyclopedia, to read means to guess, and to write means to trace. At the end of the day, because of this minefield that we're having to navigate called life in the information age, we have to be cognizant that many words and terms of art that are bandied about, even though we think they mean one thing, unless we learn about communitarianism and communitarian law and the lexicon that these people employ in academia and in policy circles and think tanks and tax-free foundations and the like, they're actually speaking another language altogether that's very similar to Orwellian newspeak or doublethink, because that's the reality. It's like I said, it's a battle for mind space, and it's a battle for perception. And we are the targets. Community does not mean what you and I ordinarily would think this word means. And the same is true of other words like environment and climate, quality of life, quality learning, free trade, responsibility to protect. These are all examples of what I term communitarian code speak. You think they mean one thing, but they almost always mean something else unless you're familiar with these words and what they mean. Easily explored on the internet today.
A lot of those buzzwords that are used by communitarians can be found in Nikki Rapana and Nordica Friedrich's book that you mentioned earlier. There's a whole glossary, I believe you would call it, of all the buzzwords that communitarians use. There's an article that you shared, Lark, with me, Communitarianism and Its Plan for Society by Trudy Lawrence. While communism established a dictatorship of the proletariat, communitarianism is a dictatorship of the community. It is called the next step, the more advanced stage of human social evolution. So what are your thoughts on this article?
Well, I think she's simply echoing the sentiments I expressed earlier.
Yeah.
You know, for the people on the right that say communitarianism must be some fancy new multisyllabic word for communism, well, they're entirely incorrect. And the same is true for the people on the so-called left who would suggest that communitarianism must be some fancy new word for fascism. The truth is that capitalism today is not about free markets and free trade and
libertarianism, as far as you're the individual and basically you have the right to be an individual, and kind of where you were going with the free trade and just pretty much a lot of the kind of mindset that a lot of the conservatives have, I would say.
Yeah, see, one way to look at communitarianism in the dialectic is that you've got the thesis, capitalism, juxtaposed against and or versus communism. So capitalism versus communism, thesis, antithesis, equals its synthesis, which is communitarianism. But the reality is this, and this is borne out even by the late I can't remember his first name, but it's Nolan Charts. Shortly before he died, he was instrumental in establishing the Libertarian Party initially. His name is Nolan. His website was nolancharts.com. Even he recognized the reality of communitarianism in the remaining few years of his life. But the truth of it is capitalism is really corporatism. And corporatism, as even Benito Mussolini during the World War II era, pre-World War II era, he said was really fascism. Fascism equals corporatism. And this is capitalism today, because no matter if it's a communist system or a capitalist system, it is the corporation which is the preferred business model. And that would include all variants thereof of a corporation. Because the truth is you, in order to divide and conquer a people, you have to compartmentalize them. And this is what has occurred since General Orders Number 100, since the Lieber Code. We've been placed under martial rule, which is very much like if you're in the military. Everyone is assigned a role and a task within a particular rank or pay grade. And each one is on a need-to-know basis. Well, the corporation itself is socialism in microcosm. Again, we've talked about this before, Nick. These are caste systems. You know, the capitals have their caste system within a corporation or a corporate structure. And that would be, of course, the shareholders, you know, ascending to descending order. Then you have the board of directors, and you have management, and then you have labor or the workers. In the communist system, ascending to descending, you have the intelligentsia, you have the nomenclatura, the bourgeoisie, and then the proletariat. And these are examples of caste system. Caste systems have existed since, you know, ancient Brahmanism. You know, the Hindus notably have a very ancient caste system still in place today. And this was certainly true with the rise of the European or medieval guild system. And that's why I think this word syndicalism is an important word to understand, because a syndicalist is described as a trade unionist, like a member of the Wobblies, for instance, back in the 30s and the 40s, for instance. But he or she that is a syndicalist is also a member of a trade association, which are generally white collar or professional trade associations. And examples of these, we can come up with many examples of trade unions, teachers unions and the like. You know, the steel workers union, you know, the port workers, the service employees international union, that would be your hospitality workers. But within the ranks of syndicalists that are white collar, we can identify, for example, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the National Governors Association, the American Medical Association, the American Bar Association, and it goes on and on and on. Syndicalism itself is a variant of socialism. Capitalism today is really corporatism, so it's socialism. And communism is a variant of socialism as well. Even libertarianism is socialist. And so I suggest that we live in a time in which a simple tripartite equation holds true. Socialism equals gangsterism equals slavery. And gangsterism is very simply organized crime made legal.
I call it cartel capitalism.
Organized crime made legal.
Yes.
I mean, our courts today are communitarian courts. They are Talmudic. And we know that there's a lot of Freemasons involved in the court system and within the ranks of the police in this country. you know, there's a long tradition of socialism in this country, beginning with the Freemasons. But it's true to say that socialism has deep roots in America. I mean, we can go back, for instance, to the social gospel movement. You know, at my old website, there's a page called Leavings, which was named for Walt Whitman and his magnum opus, Leaves of Grass. I named it Leavings. And what it is the research that I did for over about a two-week period exploring the deep roots of socialism in this country, especially amongst the Christian groups, people who identify as Christians.
According to Bill Cooper, the first communist town to have been formed was a town in Utah formed by the Mormons called Orderville.
Well, I would suggest it was Jamestown. Jamestown was a failed experiment in communism. In fact, if you look at the ship's manifest of the Mayflower, and a lot of those ship's manifest and the names of the people that were on those ships, these were people that were said to want to escape from religious persecution. Remember, we learned this in school when we were growing up?
Yes.
Well, if you go to a website called dnaconsultants.com and you do a search beginning with Abraham Lincoln's Jewish roots, eventually you're going to stumble across this word Melungeon, Melungeon. And a Melungeon is simply a person of mixed heritage. But on those ship's manifests, you're going to see a lot of people who are essentially crypto-Jews. These are people who were Jewish in Europe that changed their names. I mean, Christopher Columbus was Jewish. So was his brother Bartholomew. His name was Zarco. And Americans are taught that he's the one that discovered America.
Right.
Which is simply not true. And so, I mean, it's important to understand that a lot of people have in this country going way back, you know, they may have a mixed heritage themselves.
What are your thoughts on the discovery of America, though? You said it's not true that Columbus did. So what are your thoughts on who actually was the discoverer of America?
Well, I don't know. I think that there has been, you know, there's been settlement on these in the Americas since before recorded history. And certainly there's a lot of people who will tell you that Leif Erikson was the discoverer of America. But there's a lot of people that are said to have been discoverers of America. The truth is that Zarco, a.k.a. Christopher Columbus, the man was just a pirate. He was a privateer. I mean, he was the Nina, Pinta, and the Santa Maria were all bearing the Knights Templar flag.
Also in photographs of or paintings of Christopher Columbo, there are images of him with his claw gesture, which is a Murano Masonic gesture.
Yeah, you can actually look it up on the internet. There's actually a statue erected in his honor in the town in which he was born, which is in Spain. And it was in the toward the Basque country, if I'm not mistaken. You know, the Basque country is generally defined as being south of the Pyrenees, which is the mountain range that separates France and Spain. But yeah, Christopher Columbus was just one of those Jews that did not want to conform to what became known in history as the Spanish and the French Inquisitions. And so, they just got the hell out of town. And he was quite a sophisticated seaman. And he was funded by Jewish financiers. And, you know, he basically was a mass murderer. He's no hero. And I personally don't, I don't consider the Constitution guys, the so-called founding fathers. I'm just not a worshiper of these men. I have a kindly regard for them because of the way I was raised, and I admired their intelligence and their learning and so forth and so on. But I prefer to refer to them as the framers, because as it pertains to the Constitution, these are the people that framed the Constitution, which is basically it permitted the commoners born colonists, or what we call today Americans, to be constitutors of the debt to the crown, which is duly noted in the Treaty of Paris. So they were the framers of the con.
What do you think of the research that's coming out from Cliff Richardson and Jan Irving regarding the Bible as being a book of natural law?
Well, I would say just be wary of that, simply because there are occluded or occultic definitions for this thing called natural and law, as evidenced by a book that came out in 1841, which was quite influential with Marx and Engels. And it was called The Science of Government Founded on Natural Law by Clinton Roosevelt. You can read it on the internet. The Science of Government Founded on Natural Law. And also in 1841 was an essay that came out by a man named Joseph Pierre or Pierre Joseph, one of the other, Proudhon. And it's simply entitled, What is Property? Question mark. And this is a man who suggested that the ownership of property was tantamount to theft. And there are other documents that influenced upon people like Karl Marx and Communist Manifesto. Remember, he also later wrote something called Das Kapital.
Yes.
I think it was post-war between the states. But, yeah, this man was a frequent correspondent of Abraham Lincoln. And Abraham Lincoln's real name was Abraham Springsteen.
Yeah.
That's what I heard. His mother was Nancy Hanks. She was Jewish. And Tom Hanks is related to her.
Tom Hanks is Chabad Lubavitch.
Yes. Yeah, I think you told me that. I didn't know that.
Yes.
And then, too, we have Daniel Boone was a Melungian. Many of our country and Western performers and pop stars are Melungians today. Heather Locklear's Melungian. My goodness, Jefferson Davis was also a Melungian.
Confederate hero.
Confederate States of America. So the truth is, you have to ask yourself, well, where is their loyalty? You see, I mean, people, they have split loyalties very often, or they hide their loyalties. And we have so many people today with Irish surnames and Scottish surnames and Spanish surnames, Italian, that probably have Jews in their heritage, which is not to say this is a bad thing, but it's a reality. And so people are, you know, that came to America, they oftentimes wanted to assimilate because they didn't want to stick out. And so that's why I have a problem with white nationalism, Nick, because see, so many people, I mean, the white is a loaded word.
It was designed that way. It was designed that way, and it's almost difficult to shy away from utilizing the term white because that's just such a name brand, I guess, that a common term nowadays for describing people of European ancestry. But then there's the confusion of the Ashkenazi as being white and how they utilize the term white to their favor. They'll even call out in social media using the terminology, my fellow white people, we need to stop doing this towards such and such social group or racial group or, you know, something of that nature, to where they have the disguise of being white because they've loaded that term white to begin with.
Well, I thought it was a losing movement from the beginning, and I'm sorry to say that, but I understand. I mean, and before I forget, I mean, there's also the Sephardim, you know, and then there's also the so-called Lancados, L-A-N-C-A-D-O-S. I mean, what precisely is white, you know?
Well, you got a lot of these white nationalists that now, you know, they're a leader at one point or another, or an outspoken person in a alt-right or white nationalist group. Then they come out as saying, I just recognized or discovered my Jewish ancestry.
Well, you look at someone like Bill Gates, you know, the billionaire from Seattle area and Microsoft. He married a Dallas woman who claimed to be Roman Catholic. But is she really? You know, is she Christian or is she a crypto Jew? You know, and then look at the people like there's an article you can read on the Internet. It's simply called Europe's Kosher Right Wing Parties.
Yes. No.
Alternately titled. Europe's right-wing, quote-unquote, nationalist parties. And then we look at the leaders on the other side of the pond of the so-called nationalist movement, and then look at the leaders on this side of the pond.
Yes.
You know, Richard Spencer, who's from Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had a Jewish mentor.
Yes, Paul Gottfried. He went to University of Chicago, home of the Chicago Milton Friedman School of Economics, and the founding of neoconservatism with Leo Strauss, teaching that over there.
Yeah, lovely. Lovely. I keep telling people that they're you know, because I remember the libertarian. I used to be quite apolitical. And when I sold my company off in the end of 05, in 06, 07, and 08, I had a lot of time on my hands. And so for the first time in my life, I got involved politically. And like a lot of people, I was attracted to this guy, Ron Paul, because he sounded very different. But see, they had to introduce libertarianism into the dialectic. But if you go back and you even just do a cursory examination of the history of this thing called libertarianism, you're going to find out that it's largely socialist in nature. I mean, Cass Sunstein and Noam Chomsky both describe themselves as libertarians. You have to scratch your head. But there was a, you know, there was the first inaugural Mont Pelerin conference held in Europe. Mont Pelerin means pilgrim.
Mount Pelerin Society. Look it up, guys.
So, I mean, are these people socialists? Well, you know, it was organized by one of these libertarian heroes named Friedrich Hayek. And the minutes of that inaugural meeting were kept by Henry Hazlitt. But, you know, in attendance, we had people like Ludwig von Mises.
Yes.
The von Mises Institute, I think down in Alabama somewhere.
And then you also have the Cato Institute, which is kind of like a front for the CIA from what I've heard.
So the, you know, the individual today is faced with a rather a minefield, and we have to recognize it as such, but we have to ask ourselves what's important to us. You know, what do we want for our lives? What do we want for the ones we care about, our friends, our loved ones in particular? And so we have to go back to the beginning. Do we care about independence? Do we care about personal autonomy? And do we care about concepts like freedom and liberty in the information age?
Private ownership.
Yes. And I just don't see it because, see, we were never taught important things like the difference between a private and a public contract and a valid and an invalid contract, an honorable and a dishonorable contract. We were never we weren't taught in any of these things. I mean, even I'm 63. I remember in ninth grade, we were taking something called L.A. Studies, which is Louisiana Studies, because I attended a public school in Louisiana. And, you know, prior to those times, we had something called civics.
Yes.
That was taught in the classroom. Well, about that time, as I was taking Louisiana Studies, other school children across America were taking something called social studies. So we were incrementally, just like the Fabians, laid out the game plan when they were chartered in 1884 by the Crown in England. We were taken over and conquered gradually, incrementally.
That's why they use the symbol of the turtle for the Fabian society, is it's a slow, incremental totalitarianism that they're accomplishing.
Well, yes, and then, of course, a lot of these Fabian groups were quickly established in the Ivy League and all across the universities in America back in the 1880s. And a lot of these groups morphed into something called Pilgrim Society groups. In fact, you can do a search on the Internet today. Just simply type in your search engine, U.S. Congressional Record, 1940. British Israel World Government. And of course, British Israelism is a false religion too, that people like Bill Cooper spoke about. And, you know, frankly, that inaugural Mont Pelerin conference, because the word Pelerin in French means pilgrim, was just another pilgrim society group. So you have to ask yourself about these libertarians. And then, of course, there's another a seminal figure back in the 30s and the 40s, into the 50s, I think. His name was William James Sidis, spelled S-I-D-I-S. There's a memorial website to his memory, and it's simply Sidis.net. And he... advocated for something that he called libertarianism, and he may have been the one that actually popularized this word in America. But it was all done under beneath the rubric, under the aegis of something that he called democracy. And see, democracy is the worst form of government, short of absolute despotism or totalitarianism, which is where we are today. We are living as we're living in slavery.
Lark, I wanted to get in a show with you a while ago, and it was really something that was on my mind a lot. It has been, and it's been this universal basic income, autonomous vehicles, things of this nature, having people start riding bicycles more frequently instead of driving, the concept of not owning your own vehicle, not owning really much of anything, the future that we're going, the direction that we're going.
Well, this goes to the words technology and slavery, because I contend that we live in a time of actual techno-slavery. Let's go back to 1962, to the words of Aldous Huxley in an address at the University of California, Berkeley campus. He said that man would learn to love his slavery. Now, let's define what a technology is. A technology is a tool. What is money but a tool? Even fake money. When you have a monopoly on the issuance of currency and credit, you control the government. Who's the master? Who's the slave? You see? And then two, we've fallen in love with this high-tech stuff today. We're slaves to our smartphones and our smart meters and our cell phones and our personal computers and our Macs. We couldn't possibly think that we could live without such a thing. And yet this technology itself is harmful to human health. It's actually harmful to human health. And so language, too, is a technology. Language is perhaps mankind's oldest technology. It's a tool. And so between things like money and language and our love affair with our machines, now we can see why transhumanism has reared its ugly head. One of the isms which comprises that all-encompassing ism known as communitarianism. We can also see why we have something called the Global Happiness Report. And its ties to this thing called utilitarianism, U-T-I-L, something util, made useful. And the father of utilitarianism is a man named Jeremy Bentham. But Jeremy Bentham is also the one that wrote something that he called Panopticon, which was a model prison. So what I believe the tagline for my next installment of what I've termed a trilogy, which will be titled Techno-Slavery, the tagline is, we have met the frenemy, and he is us. Frenemy is actually a new word. It's a portmanteau or neologism, and it combines two words, friend and enemy. It's in the dictionary. Just like that word precariat is in the dictionary. This was discussed notably in the most recent Bilderberg conference. What is a precariat? A precariat is a proletariat and a man that is in a precarious way. Because in order for these capitalists and or communists to accrue more wealth and power and control unto themselves, they have to destroy the bourgeoisie and or the middle class. They have to impoverish us, because the bourgeoisie and the middle class are the only real competition to the people at the top, the uber rich. So if you can destroy your competition by expanding the nomenclatura or the bureaucracy, which is part and parcel of any kind of a socialist governing scheme, then the bureaucracy and the thought leaders and the tools of the state expand in numbers to form the firewall between the now impoverished middle classes, disappearing middle classes, including the wage slaves, the landless, the propertyless, like the proletariat, and themselves. It's a scheme to enrich the uber rich at the expense of the many. And again, it's the same old scheme being played out in world history. It's about the rule of the few over the many. And Americans today, just like Canadians and Europeans, Chinese people, Russian people worldwide, they're falling for this because they do not recognize the elephant in the room. And it is communitarianism as supported by communitarian law, which strips away individual rights and completely redefines the word rights to the point that they're no longer recognizable to the rest of us.
You have an article, Diogenes, on your blog, larkintexas.blogspot.com, white collar, the American middle classes, and there's a quote, Diogenes said, "The art of being a slave is to rule one's master." He also said, "I know nothing except the fact of my ignorance, and he has the most who is content with the least."
Yeah, Diogenes is a very interesting figure for me, because Diogenes was one of these, he lived in the same time as Plato and Socrates and Aristotle, for instance. And he used to mock Plato and his student Aristotle. He was vicious. There's a famous painting by Raphael, and it's called The School of Athens, and depicted, so they say, in the very center of that is Diogenes. Diogenes is by himself in that painting, which represents all the well-known Greek and Roman philosophers that were well-known up to that time. This is during the Renaissance. And if you want to learn some more things about Diogenes, he certainly captured my fancy at one time. There's a gentleman by the name of Ben Best, B-E-S-T, who wrote about Diogenes, easily found on the internet, and many other things. But, he's quite a character. He was the one, if you remember, he was famous for walking the streets of Athens, holding a lantern aloft, saying that he was looking for an honest man. He never found one.
How about the book We, the novel that you turned me on to, written in 1924, or completed in 1921 and published in 1924 by a Russian author, Yevgeny Yamazaten. I can't pronounce Russian names for the life of me, but could you explain the importance of why people should take a look at that novel? I think you said that a lot of the social engineers of the early 1900s, mid-1900s, were appreciative of this novel.
Well, it's very influential work. There was a man named Jerome K. Jerome, who was influential before him, also H.G. Wells, and also Jules Verne in the world of science fiction. But this man used to work for the Russian Navy, pardon me, before the Bolshevik Revolution, and then during as well, and after. But he wrote a science fiction novel entitled We, W-E, We. And his name was Yevgeny Zamyatin. And other science fiction writers like Aldous Huxley and George Orwell, a.k.a. Eric Blair, Ayn Rand, even Kurt Vonnegut, all said that their own published works that were made famous and were well received, I guess, by the public, as evidenced by the sales, were all influenced by this novel. And so I would recommend that anybody listening to the to our conversation, check it out. Just look it up. We. Perhaps go to Wikipedia even just to start and learn about it. And the plot and so forth and so on. But basically we're moving right along as Nikki posited on that same page entitled Diogenes at my old website. You know, what I call the Hegelian dialectic in a nutshell, which is also on that very short page, into a time of technological slavery. Bottom line is this, Nick, we have to decide what we want as individuals, and we have to navigate a path in this life that is now pockmarked like a minefield. There's many different directions in which we can be misled and go down empty rabbit holes and travel along the proverbial primrose path.
It's like a choose your own adventure book, but choose wisely.
Well, yeah. And it begins with learning about contract, because, I mean, even in the Constitution, you know, the law of contract was not to be impeded upon. So we have to be careful about where we sign our name. I personally try not to sign my name to anything, because I prefer oral contracts over written contracts.
Agreed.
Now, today on the internet, though, we give our permission very often. You know, you might want to share with the listeners on that page, if you're there, Nick, the five maxims of law. Do you see those?
I'll put that in the description. We've got one more minute. So what else do you recommend the listeners and viewers to do as far as with their research and what they should be focusing in on?
Learn about this word. Learn if it has any relevance to your life at all. If it doesn't have any impact upon your life, then disregard it. But bear in mind there is such a thing as communitarian law. And bear in mind that the word rights has been defined under international communitarian law. And you'll find the definition for what rights are today by reading documents like The Rights of Man by Thomas Paine, by looking up a man by the name of Paul Kurtz. Find out what kind of law they practice at the International Court of Justice at The Hague. And so if there is a contract dispute which has to be adjudicated in a court of law, between a transnational corporation or even a private individual in Germany that also involves a transnational corporation or a private individual in the United States and also one in the People's Republic of China, where should under what jurisdictions shall we adjudicate such contractual dispute? And I would recommend that everyone take a look at this thing in law called force majeure. Force majeure, FOREMAJEURE, and learn what it means. It vitiates all contracts in the event of an act of God or a natural disaster. And then look at things like communitarian redevelopment schemes and realize the role of, for instance, the American Planning Association in these events like the fires in California.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the trillion-dollar infrastructure bill proposal that will be utilized to invest into more of a police state, more technology built into the infrastructure, I would imagine, out of the $1 trillion being spent. What about you? Do you agree?
Absolutely. And I would very definitely look into the work of people like Nikki Rapana. Just do a search, Living Outside the Dialectic. You'll find her all over the internet. I'm a big fan of people like Vicki Davis and her websites.
Plug your articles also, on RBN as well. Lark on Communitarianism and Communitarianism First Things First.
Yeah, these are topics worthy of discussion. And at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is how you feel about thing. I mean, things in this world. I mean, who's the final authority at the end of the day?
Well, you would hope that it would be yourself rather than having some other party being an authority over you. You know what I mean?
Oh, yes. Perhaps next time we talk, we can talk about the nine words. And, you know, the fact that in my own life, I had to reduce all law, no matter what kind of law you call it or style it, natural law, universal law, scientific law, constitutional law, canonical, ecclesiastical law. It doesn't matter what kind of law you call it, law of the land, law of the sea, admiralty law. No matter what kind of law, I've reduced all law down to one word. And the word is counteract. And then look at the words that can be constructed just with the letters in that one word, counteract, and realize that contained therein are words like act, react, contact, contract. And what is a contract? A contract is a relationship. It's also a compact or it's a covenant. It's up to the individual to decide.
Or somebody gets conned in an act.
Amen. There's many ways to examine just that one word. But, you know, you don't have to feel small just because you haven't internalized or put the memory, you know, 10 million words.
Hey, Lark, real quick before we end our conversation, Hurricane Harvey, your thoughts on the decision of City of Dickinson, a suburb of Houston, to put a clause in an agreement and in a document for the people who have lost their homes and contractors who will be building the homes of people who lost their homes due to Hurricane Harvey, where it basically stipulates that you cannot partake in any Israeli boycotts.
Well, it's coming. I believe that very soon we're going to have hate speech laws, hate crime, and you're not even going to be able to use
Bolshevik.
You're not going to be able to use. That's right. You're not going to be able to use the word JEW or Israel even in private conversation. And it's too bad, but you know, we've got a lot of Americans who have been duped, and I was one of them. We all were. We were all socially engineered. But let's bear in mind the so-called people who call themselves Christian Zionists, dual Israeli American citizens and everything else. I mean, there are reasons why Jews do not speak out. You know, it goes to things like the Vow of Parashim, Kahila or Halakha, also the Law of the Moser, the law of Masira, but most importantly for the average rank and file American, the operative word in a system of gangsterism where organized crime has been made legal is the code of omerta, which is the code of silence. And that's what you and I are doing tonight, Nick, is we're not being silent.
Correct. Lark, thank you very much for joining me tonight and getting a lot of this out there, and all the different pieces of information will be listed in the description. So, Lark, you have a good night.
Well, thank you, sir. Enjoyed it.
Thank you. We'll be in touch very soon, I'm sure.
Cool.